hbpodcraft.com. July 12, Paris. I must have lost my head during the last few days. I must be the plaything of my enervated imagination, unless I am really a somnambulist, or I have been brought under the power of one of those influences, hypnotic suggestion, for example, which are known to exist but have hitherto been inexplicable. In any case, my mental state bordered on madness, and 24 hours of Paris sufficed to restore me to my equilibrium.
Ah, Paris. Mm. A balm for what ails you, and a great end to the story. Wow, I really love that, man.
Wait, what? It would be a great end to the story. I'd probably feel a lot happier.
But it's not really the end of the story.
No, it's not the end, but it is a paragraph from Guy de Maupassant's The Horla, which is the story that we have been covering here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, I'm Chris Lackey.
And I am Chad Pfeiffer. What's been going on so far in the story?
Well, our protagonist is this upper-class French guy who lives by himself and starts having these kind of waking dreams of someone trying to kill him or suck his life force out or, you know, other kind of things. He's not sure if he's going crazy or not. Maybe he is. Right now, he's leaning towards crazy. He's having problems. But this strange thing happens where his water and food in his room that is locked at night because he's kind of paranoid is disappearing. So he thinks maybe he's sleepwalking and drinking it, or that there's some kind of extra dimensional entity that is eating his food and drinking his water.
It's really upsetting him. Right before the section that we just heard where he goes to Paris, he conducts a little test where he puts water and milk out on his table.
Yeah.
And he wraps the bottles in white muslin and ties down the stoppers, and then he rubs his lips, his beard, and his hands with pencil lead, and then he goes to sleep. But in the morning, the muslin's still in place on the bottles, and when he unwraps them, he sees they're empty, and there's no markings on them. So he wasn't the one that was doing it, which is a little creepy.
Right.
It's got a kind of a supernatural bent to it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if you're suffering from some kind of mental illness here, what is to stop him from just wiping his hands off and face off in his altered state, drinking the stuff, putting it back on and going to bed? I mean, that would be my logical explanation for it, not that there's interdimensional beings trying to attack
him. Well, I was sad when he unwrapped it and there were no markings on it or anything. It felt like because he'd rubbed all that lead on there that there should be a punchline, you know, like when you dream of eating marshmallows and you wake up and your pillow's gone. You know, I wanted him
right,
to be like,
right, okay.
There were no markings on all the bottles, but somebody had drawn sketches of my lips on this photo of Olivia Newton-John. You know, there's like the ink goes somewhere, the lead goes somewhere. Well, ONJ was big back then.
Oh my God, yeah, absolutely.
People don't remember that.
I had the biggest crush on her in Xanadu, man.
Yeah, Coleridge wrote the original draft of Xanadu.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, hey, the opening, the reader at the beginning there, by the way, was Erwan G. Marshall, who did it for us last time.
Yep.
Again, coming in with the crazy French accent. Anyhow, so he came to Paris, had a good time, right?
Yeah, he's doing great. He feels much better. When he's away, he realizes, oh, you know what? My problems aren't so bad.
He actually has two realizations in that section when he's in Paris, where he says, when we were alone for a long time, we people space with phantoms.
Right.
And then he also says, you know, instead of dismissing a problem with we do not understand because we cannot find the cause, we immediately imagine terrible mysteries and supernatural powers.
Yeah.
So getting away to Paris and having his head clear, he nails the two things that are probably, you know, what's going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think, I don't know if anybody else has thought about this, but is it something about his house that's doing this? Like, I thought, does he have a carbon monoxide leak or something?
Oh.
Because every time he leaves, he feels better. Right. And then when he came back, his coachman was like, oh, I've been feeling bad too.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
He's got a leak and it's causing these hallucinations and just nobody knows about it. Because, I mean, I remember hearing stories as early as 1920s where this would affect certain people. Maybe I'm being crazy because this is taking place in the 1890s. There's probably nothing like that. But something in his house that's doing this to him. Maybe there's an explanation there.
It could be. It could be. I mean, we don't get one in the story, however.
Right. But
I'm going to bring this up. Somebody posted on one of our comments, you know, that story, the werewolf that we were covering.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, somebody pointed this out. I felt like an idiot for not realizing it. Remember in the beginning of the story, how there's the knock at the door and it sounds like a kid and they open the door, nobody's there. And it sounds like a woman and then nobody's there. And then it sounds like a man and nobody's there.
Yeah.
Well, somebody pointed out that it's kind of a premonition because
first a
kid dies. And I totally missed that.
Oh, really? I just thought we ran out of time and didn't talk about
it.
No, it's the kid and then the old woman and then the man is, well, you don't know. It's supposed to have been
Swain.
Was it Christian or was it, you know, some kind of precognitive ghost of Swain's death. It's hard to know. Nah, yeah, I felt bad when I listened to those episodes that we didn't get back around to cover that, but
yeah, well,
certainly that it was a cool premonitory.
Keep trying, Ted. Don't give up.
Happening. Kind of like the Signal Man, you know, where you see the ghost before the bad thing happens.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Back to this.
No, I'm glad you brought that up because it probably did make us seem a little dumb. We just didn't get to it.
Oh, no, you didn't get to it. I was dumb.
I don't have anything to say to that. This thing that happens in Paris, though, is you remember earlier in the Horla, there was this priest that told him a whole story about the wind and all these forces that we can't see. Now he's in Paris and he runs into another terrible influence, which is this guy, Dr. Parent.
Right. Now he meets Dr. Parent through his cousin who he's visiting with. He's having a meal with his cousin and her husband. His cousin's a woman. A few other people, and this Dr. Parent is married to a friend of his cousin.
And he's a medical man, but he's also really into this mesmer hypnotism junk.
Right.
He's saying things like, you know, man endeavors to supplement the feeble penetration of his organs by the efforts of his intellect, but we really can't see what's out there. You know, mesmer and some others have put us on this unexpected track. We're really getting closer to understanding these crazy things that actually are preying on our minds all the time. And this is all stuff he really shouldn't be saying to our protagonist.
Yeah, to this guy.
And then he pulls a little Kreskin here, doesn't
he? This is pretty crazy, yeah. I never heard of this bit before, but it was really neat where he hypnotizes her and he takes just like a blank card and he tells her it's a mirror and to hold it up. And he says, okay, now you do stuff behind her and asks her what is going on behind her. And she can see this on cardboard. Like it's not really a mirror. And I'm like, well, that's pretty creepy and crazy. But then even he gives an explanation where, well, he could have slipped a mirror in his hand and had a mirror holding up, you know, so that we couldn't see it, but she could see the mirror.
Yeah.
So he gave a reasonable explanation to it.
But still, it was an interesting demonstration of whatever these latent powers are.
Latent powers or trickery.
It's one or the other, yeah. But then the doctor does a little, what I think is quite cruel to this woman.
Yeah.
And he hypnotizes her and he implants the suggestion, at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, you're going to get up. You're going to call on your cousin, who's our protagonist, and at his hotel, and you're going to ask him to lend you 5,000 francs because your husband needs it. And that's what he kind of implants in her head. And then the next day, she shows up and she asks for it, right?
Yeah. She's like, I need this money. And he goes, no, cousin, you were hypnotized. Remember he asked you to go to sleep and you remember you went to sleep? And she's like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, he hypnotized you. That's not really going on. And she just goes, but my husband needs this money.
Right. That's beside the point.
Yeah. Why you keep bringing up Dr. Parent? My husband needs this money. And he's like, no, you're missing it. And he talks about how he can see her brain just isn't like she's almost agreeing. She almost goes, oh, yeah, OK, I get it. But you can see it. And then she goes, no, I need the money. And it upsets him to see how paralyzed she is, how under control she is of this suggestion. And he finally calls Dr. Parent over and he comes over and does away with it.
Yeah, he implants another suggestion that says you don't need the money. Forget that you asked him to lend it to you. Yeah. And if he does talk to you about it, you're not going to understand what he's saying.
Yeah.
And then that's exactly what happens to you.
That's exactly what happens.
She's like, I didn't do that. What are you talking about? So he just manipulates her to prove this point. But it seems like a lot of unnecessary. Why didn't he just have her walk like a chicken or something? I mean, why does he have to make her go through this whole thing where she's crying and demanding this money?
Yeah,
and, you know?
I don't know. I guess the walk like a chicken thing. Well, no, I mean, she could be in on it, even if this is part of it. So I don't, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, except that it's a lot more dramatic.
Absolutely.
And it's better writing.
You're right. If he just walked like a chicken, it would have been kind of, I would have been making fun of that right now.
Yeah,
that's true. They had this opportunity to do something cool, and that's all she did.
Have you ever seen any of the live hypnotist people?
I was going to ask you the same thing. I never have.
No, I haven't.
I'm very, very skeptical of it.
Well, as far as I can tell, and it's what I've read, because I've done some reading on this, is that some people are susceptible to suggestion, but they won't necessarily do anything that would really harm them or really be against their judgment.
Yeah.
So people, not everybody, but a few people, I think it's something, from what I've read, you know, 1 in 10 people are very susceptible to suggestion. Now, I know the magician, Darren Brown, does a lot of hypnotism, and he says that it indeed works. And he had a whole show on where he thought that the Manchurian Candidate scenario would work. And so he did this whole show where he told people that he was doing something else, and he found this guy who was really susceptible to suggestion. And they did things like they had ice cold water, like a tank full of ice, and they had the guy, they hypnotized him. He says, "This water feels warm to you." And he could just got inside of it and was fine. Like, he didn't freak out at all. And he didn't tense up. You know, you can see your body. If you hit cold water, your body. So I was like, man, that seems pretty legitimate. He trains this guy to do a Manchurian candidate assassination where he confuses him to the point that he's going to shoot Stephen Fry. And he picks up a gun.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, he picks up a gun and shoots him. And everybody in the theater knows that it's a put on, but the guy supposedly doesn't know it's a put on. So he's going there to watch Stephen Fry. He gets the signal. And then he reaches under his seat, pulls out a gun, and shoots Stephen Fry, puts the gun away, and then leaves, and then doesn't remember any of it. Supposedly. Whether or not that, you know, this is, I mean, he is a magician, so you gotta take what he says.
Well, I remember Matt Barisi in college used to play this game called Naughty Hypnotist with his girlfriend, and
it worked.
She didn't seem to be too skeptical about it, so.
All right, well, okay.
Yeah, that's proof enough for me.
Another point there to hypnotism is real. Now, back to the story. Yeah, he comes home. There's some servants quarreling about some broken glasses in a cupboard. Nobody knows who did it. They don't, you know, they're all blaming each other. He's not sure exactly what that's about, but then he experiences something that is really supernatural, which is basically he's out in the afternoon walking in the garden. He sees a flower being picked by an unseen hand and then like lifted up, and he runs to try and grab the flower, and then it just kind of disappears.
Yeah.
So for him, sold. There is an invisible creature that can interact with our world, do these things. And I'm like, that's, wow, I don't know, man. That's still, you could have maybe just misperceived something or.
Yeah, in that section, he says, "Oh, I'm certain now this is happening." The next entry, he says, "By the way, I would love somebody to make a short film of that scene, and I dare them to make it scary." Oh my God, that flower is being sniffed by nobody.
Yeah.
In the next section, he says, "I've seen mad people, and I've known some of them. They were real bright, but there was just one thing they couldn't get their head around." And he's like, "You know, if I would think I was crazy if I weren't conscious of the fact that I'm crazy." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's got this really warped justification where it's like, he says, some people, you know, they'll get in an accident and then they'll lose only one part of their brain that helps them recognize faces. Or maybe they can't remember numbers or verbs or something. Maybe I'm injured somehow and I just can't tell the difference between hallucinations and what's real.
Yeah.
So, you know, he vacillates between being certain of what's going on and then questioning his mental state as well.
Yeah.
And it really reminded me, my grandmother went through this. She was lived well into her 90s, very bright. She didn't have any dementia or Alzheimer's, but she did have macular degeneration.
What's that?
Which is basically parts of your eyes that stop being able to see, I guess.
Okay.
It's a simple way to put it. But basically, there were big blind spots in her field of vision.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have some of those anyway. I mean, everybody's got blind spots.
Right.
And your brain just fills
in
the details.
I've done that little test, yeah.
So she had so many of them that her brain was filling in the blanks, but with some crazy things sometimes.
A lot of details. Wow.
So she would be like convinced that people were outside of her window, like trying to get in, because she would look out the corner of her eye and they'd be there. And then she'd look again and they'd disappear. And she would call the police like all the time.
Oh,
somebody's
no.
trying to get into my home, and they'd show up and then they'd call us and what's going on. And they would think that, and for her, it was really trying because there might have been some kind of senility there that was contributing to this. But for the most part, it was like you could tell she knew there was probably nothing there.
Right.
But is this the time where I'm going to go, oh, no, I'm just hallucinating and some people come in and kill me? So it was just like she would always follow it through with and then feel so silly because she's like, I kind of knew it wasn't real. I felt so bad for her because I was watching her go crazy about it, you know.
Yeah.
And it really, just in this moment where he was talking about that, just really hit me, you know. Because you might be well aware of the fact that there's probably nothing there, but that little bit of doubt.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Could really drive you nuts.
Yeah. I mean, even I will hear a noise at night and think, oh, somebody's breaking into the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's where my brain goes. It's the first place I go, somebody's breaking into the house. And then I have to go, now, would somebody really, if somebody was breaking into the house, don't you think it would sound really obvious, as in you would hear footsteps and you would hear the sound of the glass and all those things? And then I have to remember that I'm an attached house. You know, it's like a duplex.
Yeah.
A lot of times you can hear people next door, but it sounds like it's coming from inside your house because the floors are connected and the walls and things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have to go, wait a minute, hold on. You know what? Nobody's in the house.
Except, yeah, I mean, it's probably ghosts or something, but no people.
No people, yeah. And ghosts are friendly here in Yorkshire, so.
Oh, really?
I didn't know that. They're great. Do your laundry and stuff for you. It's amazing.
Aw. For a while, he doesn't see or feel direct effects from the thing. But while he's at home, he always has that feeling of the creature's presence, you know, that it's near him, it's watching him. And it starts to influence his mood so badly that he can't go anywhere or do anything. He wants to just jump in his carriage and get out of town because he knows that's going to make him feel better. But he feels like he has to stay in this chair, you know?
Yeah.
There's a journal entry here that kind of illustrates it. It says,
August 14. I am lost. Somebody possesses my soul and governs it. Somebody orders all my acts, all my movements, all my thoughts. I am no longer master of myself. Nothing except an enslaved and terrified spectator of the things which I do. I wish to go out. I cannot. He does not wish to. And so I remain, trembling and distracted in the armchair in which he keeps me sitting. I merely wish to get up and to rouse myself so as to think that I am still master of myself. I cannot. I am riveted to my chair, and my chair adheres to the floor in such a manner that no force of mine can move us. Then suddenly, I must go to the foot of my garden to pick some strawberries and eat them. And I go there. I pick the strawberries and I eat them. Oh, my God! My God, is there a God?
Again, this would be really hard to make scary in a movie.
I must pick strawberries! He's possessed by the purple pie man.
Again, I mean, this story to me is just, it's mental illness, man. It just totally sounds like that. The supernatural element is just sort of a flavoring or his delusion. But again, there's never really anything to me that happens in the story that can't be explained through mundane means.
Yeah. And certainly whatever physical evidence that he has, such as the milk and the water being drunk or the flower flying through the air, none of that supports where he goes with this.
No.
You know, he kind of makes a connection to the hypnotism and says, you know, when my cousin was hypnotized, she was under the power of a strange will that had kind of entered into her. And then from that, he's like, is there an invisible being that's doing that to me? And then he goes, yes, yes, that is what's happening. Yeah. In fact, I'm starting to think that there's a whole race of these peoples that are coming from outer space. Well, I'm jumping ahead. Yeah. He does manage to escape to go to Rouen once, right?
Yeah.
He gets out and he gets to his carriage and he takes off and he goes.
And he's ready to say to the coachman, he's going, take me to the train station. But what comes out of his mouth is, take me back home. And he's like, well, why did I say that? I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go to the train station. It's this power.
It reminded me, you know, speaking of control and possession, it reminded me of The Thing on the Doorstep by H.P. Lovecraft, when the poor guy is being controlled by his wife.
Yeah.
And he gets in the car and he manages to escape. And then suddenly he'll be like, I don't know what was wrong with me. I should just go home and be placid again, you know?
Yeah, but that's obviously supernatural.
Oh, yes, yes. Then. But yeah, there's no unreliable narrator there. It's actually happening. Well, you know, what's interesting about the Horla is what we're reading here is really the third version of it. A few came out. The first one was called Letter from a Madman that came out in 1885.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a device of it being like a letter. And then the Horla came out in 1886, but that was like a doctor's point of view relating the story. And the one that came out in 1887 is this final reworking that we have here, where it's these journal entries and we're very much inside the head of the protagonist. So it took him a little bit of time to figure out how he wanted to tell this story. Well, it took 3 years. Anyway, let's get back to the story here. Now, he's doing some reading in all kinds of literature to try and figure out what this thing is. He reads this whole thing about hairstyles, doctor philosophy, and theogony.
Yeah, that's not a real guy. There's a name of a part of Paris, I believe, that is called that.
So it's some he invented?
Yeah, he invented that. The writer.
That's cool. He's doing some Lovecraft stuff there. He made up a book to kind of... Well, definitely this takes a real... From that August 17th entry where he's talking about his reading, it takes a real sci-fi bent suddenly.
Yeah.
This must have been what really appealed to Lovecraft. Where he's saying, you know, there's always been these invisible beings and we've used our tales of the supernatural to kind of figure out what they are or describe mm-hmm. them. But maybe, you know, he looks up at the sky and he's thinking, who inhabits those worlds out there? Who are the thinkers in these distant worlds and wouldn't they know more than us? And can they do more than us? And can they see things that we can't see?
Right.
It's pretty, you know, whisper in the darkness kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, won't they come over here at some point and try to subjugate us? Because we're so... weak. He says we are weak, powerless, ignorant, so small. living on this particle of mud which revolves in liquid air. Right. I mean, you just couldn't get closer to the Lovecraft kind of idea.
Or V, for that matter.
Or V, for that matter. That's right. Well,
I'm talking about the Mark Singer V, not that newfangled one that just came out.
Oh, yeah, dude. Mark Singer is so awesome. That guy really knows how to hold a gun and run down hallways.
On that show, his shirt was unbuttoned pretty much to his navel.
Yeah, I know.
And he made it work.
Beastmaster 2 Through the Portal of Time, however.
Oh.
That is Mark Singer's finest film.
Yeah.
I recommend anybody who's interested in
cinema of any kind.
In cinema of any kind, go out and rent that.
It is a genre film, but it crosses genre.
It was robbed in all award ceremonies of that entire decade.
Robbed?
Speaking of cinema, there's a little Evil Dead action kind of thing that happens here where our protagonist falls asleep in this next journal entry. And then when he wakes up, he sees a page turn on the book at his desk all by itself.
Right.
So he keeps real still. And about 4 minutes later, he sees, again, the page lift and fall down. So this thing is like reading.
Uh-huh.
It's sitting at his desk. So he jumps up to grab it and the chair falls over and the window opens up.
Yeah, like something runs away.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It just had that kind of, I like it when heroes have to fight with their environment, you know, and had that Ash kind of feeling.
It does. Absolutely.
Like everything in the room starts going crazy. But then there's a right after that, there's a realization. If you were to take this as a supernatural story, this is the kind of important arc. Because earlier in the very beginning of the story, he talks about how he sees this, what, like a Brazilian ship pass his...
Yeah, it's got the Brazilian flag, and he sees it, and he remembers that part of it, because he reads here that there is this story of a village, São Paulo, that these people were basically, a bunch of people were possessed.
Yeah.
Like lots of people. And they drank lots of water and milk without touching it. Somehow they were able to nourish themselves. And he's like, "What? That's what happened to me. That's the thing."
Yeah. And then he goes, "Wait a minute. I saw that Brazilian ship pass by and my house looked all white and inviting over here. Like something hopped off and came here from Brazil. This is like when bananas come out and they have little spiders living on them."
Right.
This is the exact thing that happened.
Exact same thing.
And right away he's going, "Oh, the reign of man is over and he has come." He's really buying into this idea that this is an invisible master from another planet.
That they're invading all of humanity, not just him.
He says, "You know, the vulture has eaten the pigeon, the wolf has eaten the lamb, the lion has devoured the buffalo. Man kills the lion with an arrow, but the horla is going to make of man what man has made of the horse and the ox. You know, his slave is food, using the power of its will." And that's where he names the creature. And the way he names it, it's kind of almost like he makes the horla name itself. He's saying, "The what? What does he call himself? I feel like he's shouting it to me right now and I can't hear him. I'm listening. Horla, that's what it is, the horla." So it's almost like he's a medium in a seance or something like that at that point when it names itself. And we talked a little bit about what the meaning of that name is in the last episode.
The outsider, basically.
Yeah. It goes on for a long time where he talks about how powerful these beings are and why they're going to come and they're going to destroy us. And he kind of gets this notion, "I got to fight back. I'm going to kill this Horla that's haunting me. Just like a dog will turn on its master. That's what I'm going to do." And there's this interesting thing that happens where he sets up a trick to capture or at least see the Horla. Where he's got all the lights going on in his room, his mirrors on the wall across from, you know, his back at the desk. And he's going to nonchalantly be writing at his desk because he knows the Horla can't resist. Eventually, it's going to look over his shoulder to try and read what he's writing. And so he's doing this.
How does he know that?
He just knows. Well, because he saw the Horla reading. So this is a very bookish monster.
Right.
But he seems to know this. Yeah. So he's writing at his desk. He feels right at that moment where the Horla is watching him. And he jumps up and reaches out and tries to grab at what it is.
"I got up so quickly with my hands extended that I almost fell. Horror. It was bright as at midday, but I did not see myself in the glass. It was empty, clear, profound, full of light. But my figure was not reflected in it, and I was opposite to it. I did not venture to make a movement, feeling certain, nevertheless, that he was there. But that he would escape me again. He, whose imperceptible body had absorbed my reflection. And then suddenly, I began to see myself through a mist in the depths of the looking glass. In a mist, as it were, or through a veil of water. And it seemed to me as if this water were flowing slowly from left to right and making my figure clearer every moment. It was like the ends of an eclipse. I had seen him. And the horror of it remained with me and makes me shudder even now."
It was a really cool scene. I mean, it's like a special effects scene in the middle of this, you know.
I'm a little confused to what happened. Like, he looked and he wasn't in the mirror himself?
Yeah, because he's sitting there at his desk with things right behind him, almost leaning over his ear. So when he spins around, it's between him and the mirror. And so he doesn't see his own reflection because it's being blocked by the Horla.
Now I see. Okay, now I got it.
So even though it looks, he can't see the Horla, it's blocking him. And then as the Horla leaves, he materializes in the mirror again because the Horla is kind of running away. But the Horla is somewhat insubstantial, so it's almost like this kind of gauzy, slow fade up of his image in the mirror. I really liked it. It took me a second to figure out what the heck was going on, too.
But now that you explain it, it sounds really cool.
And I can imagine that would actually be pretty creepy if you did, you know, film it or something like that, as opposed to the flying daisy. Yeah. He comes into what is basically his final plan in these next few journal entries. He orders some iron shutters for his room that hotels have in Paris on the ground floor. I mean, this is kind of like thief repellent shutters. You can't get out once you're shut in with these things. Mm-hmm. This is the way he lays it out. He gets a locksmith there. He puts iron shutters on the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then he is in there in his room with everything open.
Yeah.
Until about midnight. And then suddenly he feels the Horla's presence.
Right.
And so nonchalantly gets up, closes the window, kind of carelessly puts his boots and slippers on. Like, he's just puttering around the room. He's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
Then he fastens the iron shutters on the door and locks it with a padlock, putting the key in his pocket, and he can tell the thing is starting to go, wait a minute, what's going on? You know, he can feel the tension from the thing.
Right.
And then through the last door, he's real tall, so he fills the whole door frame. He slides out backwards and shuts the door, so he knows nothing came out with him. Otherwise, he would have felt it.
Right.
And now he's got the Horla contained in that room. And then
he sets the house on fire.
Exactly. He sets the house on fire, and he runs out to hide in the garden. And I thought, what a great plan. That's actually pretty smart. You know, he's going to burn his place down. And then he starts to hear screaming from the house.
And he's like, oh, wait, I didn't tell the help that I was going to do this.
I couldn't believe it.
Oh.
He forgot the servants and is burning them alive inside the house.
Yeah.
I think he kills them. Like, I don't think they escape.
No.
Because he says the house was nothing but a magnificent funeral pyre where men were burning.
And again, that's, I feel that nothing supernatural happened here. It's all just the work of a madman.
Instead of it just being the work of a madman, you know, hurting himself, unfortunately,
yeah,
he killed some people. And he thinks, I did it, I did it, and he's got to be in there, he's got to be dead, right? And it ends this way.
Dead? Perhaps. His body? Was not his body, which was transparent, indestructible by such means as would kill ours? Why this transparent, unrecognizable body, this body belonging to a spirit, if it also had to fear ills, infirmities, and premature destruction? Premature destruction. All human terror springs from that. After man, the Horla. After him who can die every day, at any hour, at any moment, by any accident, he came. He was only to die at his own proper hour and minute, because he had touched the limits of his existence. No. 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 There is no doubt about it. He is not dead. Then, I suppose I must kill myself.
And that is the end of the story.
And we know from Maupassant's biography that he actually, a couple of years later, tried to kill himself.
Yep.
In much the same way, which I think is the real dark association between this story and his real life.
Yeah.
Now, why do you think he decided he had to kill himself?
I think complete despair.
You think it's just, I have to get out of the picture, but the Horla wins, like he's letting it win?
And also, he won't be used by the Horla. It's not going to be able to control him and make him a puppet. So if he kills himself, then he'll be free and the Horla will be one less mook. This is a really well-written story. It's really interesting. When I read it, I was a little disappointed that it wasn't. For me, it's not supernatural at all. It's just a guy losing his mind. I've been hankering for some supernatural stuff because that's the way I roll.
I hear you. I mean, I like a story like this that's psychological.
But the problem for me was, it was, I think, my expectation of the story. Like, I was hoping that it was a supernatural story. If I would have known going into it, it's about this man's descent into madness, I think I would have enjoyed it a lot more. I still enjoy it. I still thought it was cool. I was just a little disappointed.
Lovecraft's description of it probably didn't help you very much because it says, relating the advent in France of an invisible being who lives on water and milk, sways the minds of others, and seems to be the vanguard of a horde of extraterrestrial organisms arrived on Earth to subjugate and overwhelm mankind. This tense narrative is perhaps without peer in its particular department. Now, from what he said there,
yeah,
I would think that there are really extraterrestrial organisms in the story. It's kind of like how he described the yellow wallpaper. You know, it's almost like Lovecraft, he doesn't see the two levels. He just goes, oh, it's supernatural, because I like that better.
Right. Or he just isn't tipping the author's hand. Like, yeah. he wants people to go in and see it this way and then be surprised by the fact, oh, it's not really that. It's about something else. At least I'm giving Lovecraft the benefit of the doubt.
Oh, and you should, because he's a super smart guy.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I have much more to say on the story other than I really dug it. And sounds like a lot of people that wrote in from the last episode have enjoyed reading it themselves. So cool. I had thought originally that it might take us 3 episodes to cover it, but it's not. So we've got that open slot, and we were trying to figure out, you know, what E.F. Benson story we wanted to throw in there. And
we're going to go with Negotium Perambulans.
Yeah.
Did I say that right? Negotium Perambulans?
What Lovecraft says about that is, he said, Mr. Benson's volume Visible Invisible contains several stories of singular power, notably Negotium Perambulans, whose unfolding reveals an abnormal monster from an ancient ecclesiastical panel, which performs an act of miraculous vengeance in a lonely village on the Cornish coast. So, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm into that. That sounds pretty great. Hopefully it's not just some guy going crazy.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I think there's actually going to be a monster in that one. So you're going to get your wish, Chris.
Yahoo!
I want to thank Erwan G. Marshall for reading for us once again. Good job, pal.
Yeah, man.
All right, with that, I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We'll be back next week with E.F. Benson.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and I will also be back with little E.F. Benson.
You've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.